This week on Pop of Culture, we work at a tiny desk.
We're not looking for a specific genre. We're just looking for someone who is just like really them in a real way.
We talk to a producer of the hit NPR series.
We also work from a sculpture workshop and a greenhouse.
I decide, okay, well, I'll pick up some plants and I'll try my hand at it. And I killed each and every one of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so I reevaluated.
Coming up, Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. We have two incredible milestones to celebrate today.
This week marks 1 year on the air at IPR.
Woohoo! And with that, this week is our 50th, oh yes, you heard that right, 50th episode.
Woohoo!
Pot of Time, Tasty Beverages on me.
Excellent.
After all the places we've been in the last year, we start today behind a tiny desk. Joining us is Bobby Carter from NPR's Tiny Desk. Bobby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. What's up? How you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling really good because I get to talk about Tiny Desk, which is one of my most favorite things in the whole wide world. Specifically, the Tiny Desk contest. But before we get to that, Bobby, tell me about your Tiny Desk story. How did you land behind the desk?
Oh, how did I land behind the desk? I landed behind the desk by pitching Tiny Desk, my bands that I wanted to play at the Tiny Desk back in 2014. I started my career with the series co-creator Bob Boylan. I was his intern 25 years ago. And when NPR Music was created, and ultimately when Tiny Desk was created, I started pitching bands that I thought would make a good fit for the desk. And finally, in 2014, I pitched my first show. And I've been in the fold ever since.
Wow. What was that first show? I have to know.
The Foreign Exchange. It was an MC, singer, slash producer duo. One of the first bands to ever create a full album virtually. This is back in, I don't know, this is back in 2008, I believe.
Ooh, the olden days.
The olden days. So yeah, they were really, really revolutionary in terms of how they created. And yeah, they made it to the desk. Those are good friends of mine.
Nice. So what have been some of your favorite Tiny Desk concerts since then?
Oh boy.
I know there's so many, right?
So many. Sesame Street is a fun one. Obviously, Anderson .Paak was great.
Oh my gosh! Don't even get me started on that, Bobby. That is brilliant from start to finish. That's what turned me on to Anderson, and I'm a huge fan. Following him ever since. Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the I did that one not too long after the Foreign Exchange came, but there's so many, Michelle. So many, you know, our producers are just great at just discovering just talent that's out there, but maybe untapped. Those are the ones that I'm most proud of that sort of have a moment at the desk and sort of helps put fire under whatever they're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking of bringing attention to those who may not be getting the love they deserve, you created the Tiny Desk contest in 2014. For those who may be unfamiliar, tell us a little bit about how that came about and why that exists.
Yeah, well, the contest came about because we get so many submissions. We get so many pitches from unsigned acts and signed acts alike to want to come and play the desk.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we can't say yes to everything. We have to sometimes say no to artists that we like, that we really, really enjoy.
Sure.
So as our platform continued to grow and explode, the thought was to lend the platform to someone that no one has ever heard of, to a band that nobody's ever heard of. So to a band that's unsigned and help start a music career. And it was a fun way to get submissions from around the country and pick one, and the winner gets to play a real Tiny Desk.
Yeah.
And start a real career in music. So it's just a way to lend our platform to those acts that, you know, people may not see or hear.
Sure. Talk a little bit about how the contest has grown over the years. Like, your early years, how many submissions are we talking about? And I know that now we're talking about thousands, right?
Thousands, yeah. Literally thousands. So, yeah, definitely the amount of entries has grown over the years. But also, in the same way that the Tiny Desk has really evolved in terms of genre and walks of life and generation, I think, and I look at, you know, the submissions for the contest, and I think that's evolved in the same way. You know, we see much more jazz. We see a lot of classical. We're always going to see our indie and our singer-songwriters, but people have really started to experiment with the way that they present themselves in a live and intimate setting, in the same way that you see at the desk. So there's been a lot of evolution there. That's the thing I'm most excited about.
Yeah. Wonderful. So what goes, this has got to be a major task, a huge undertaking. What goes into selecting a winner, and what qualities make an artist stand out among these thousands of entries?
Yeah, well, we have a great team. Our Tiny Desk team is on the job looking at each and every entry. We go through multiple rounds. We have a great judging panel this year. And we just, the moment the contest closes, which is this year on February 10th, we just start going through every single entry, trying to find that special thing that really lights us up inside. What we're looking for, I always say, someone who goes against the grain, someone who stands out. It could be just a voice, a God-given gift that you never heard before in a vocal. It could be something quirky and funky. It could be something sad that emotes something that, you know, that's unfamiliar inside of us. You know what I mean? So it's someone that really stands out in a way that we've never seen before. So I always tell, you know, artists and bands who are thinking about entering to just go look at some of our winners in the past. Go look at our 10 winners and look at their video and.
Yeah.
Tell me that each and every one of those didn't stick out, didn't bring something out in you that you've never seen before. So, I you know, just take the opportunity to perfect your entry. Do it over again if you need to. Look at some of your favorite Tiny Desk concerts and bring that all together and see if you can come up with something really cool.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of the qualities would be something that sticks with you. Obviously, with the judges are watching a lot of submissions, you're listening to a lot of different bands. It's going to be those songs, those sounds, that hook, something that you can't get out of your head, right? That carries them through. Yeah,
exactly. It could be a message in the song. It could be, you know, for example, last year's winner, What's It All Mean? It's like, it speaks to the people who work hard every day and to no end. When you look at Elisa Amador, who won a few years ago, it's just like an emotion inside that sweet voice and just her locking eyes with the audience. It could be something funky and so fun, like a Tank and the Bangers. I mean, it's just like there's so many angles that you could come from. But just whatever it is, be yourself. If you have a unique quality, like, really lean into that and really, really push that forward, because we're not looking for a specific genre. We're just looking for someone who is just like really them in a real way.
Yeah. And we want a lot of anybody that is listening to this podcast right now that is in a band or a musician. We want them to get involved. What would you say to them to give them that extra like push to like really get involved in Tiny Desk, whether it's this year or future years?
It's for me, it's an opportunity to join a community. It's an opportunity to be fulfilled inside and just to say you did it, just to have the feeling like I really put myself out there. And listen, we've had people who submitted who didn't win, who eventually made their way to the desk and to perform at a Tiny Desk anyway.
Yeah.
We've had someone named by the name of Selena Moon.
Yeah.
Grammy winner, Sierra Farrell. She entered the contest a few years ago.
Yeah, she's great.
it just, you know, it doesn't end with just winning. You know, to me, it's a win if you put yourself out there, because I know it takes a lot for you to put your art out there and to, you know, expose yourself like that. So just do it.
That's right. Just do it. Well, thank you so much, Bobby, for taking the time to tell us about the contest. And we look forward to seeing who's going to come out on top this year.
Michelle, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Bobby Carter is producer for NPR's Tiny Desk Concert and a judge for the Tiny Desk Contest. Entries for that, by the way, are due Monday, February 10th. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Kara Duquette. On the first floor of Ball State's Art and Journalism Building, lovingly called AJ, are a series of workshops dedicated to learning sculpture. That's where we met up with Michael Lorsung, an assistant professor of art and sculpture. He was wearing work boots, safety glasses, and holding a large Dunkin' cold brew. As he walked us through the workshop, he talked about how he takes students from learning the basics of sculpture to being ready for the real world.
So for me, sort of job readiness, preparing students for the world, is not about imparting a prescribed set of physical or even cognitive skills. It's about developing a mindset of, I can probably do that.
Well, yes, and this is where we met originally in immersive learning,
right,
and the high impact practices that Ball State has adopted. And one of those is immersive learning, and you took a class out in the world to create something, correct?
Yeah. And I mean, I would say that, like, you know, I always sort of, you know, it's been curious to me since I started here, and other places where we talk about immersive learning, because it's like anything that we're doing here is immersive learning. And the idea that somehow I have, like, that there's like a separation there, it's like, I think it's, you know, for me, it's a little bit funny, because it's not taking students from a lecture hall out into the world. It's like, we're already doing that. You know, students are already sort of involved in that process whenever they're in a studio here, because they're involved physically and actively with the material, and then they're linking that back to cognitive principles. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like the School of Art, I think, as a whole, is doing a really good job of sort of executing that mission inside and outside of the formalized structure of immersive learning.
As we discussed Michael's work as a professor, he told us about a particular woodworking class where students begin to think about conceptual art, moving beyond just recreating everyday objects.
And part of what the students have to do in the process of doing this is an exploration of value and how do you understand value, not necessarily exclusively in a commodified capital sense, but is that they're making two objects. The objects are not sort of fixed forms, so they're not making a cup or an ashtray or a hat stand or a stool. But they are deriving their forms from an amalgamation of objects that they find interesting in the world. And then they're creating sort of a mashup of those things, and they're duplicating it. So they're learning how to sort of work from form. They're learning how to interpret form. And then they're, through the process of all of this, I've asked them to think about, how do we understand value in objects? How do we establish value in objects that we don't understand, that are new to us? How is it that we can approach something and pick it up for the first time and go, like, this feels like it might be valuable? Or we see something and we go, that looks like it might be valuable. What are the sort of cues to us there? How do we sort of understand that value? Where do those values come from? You know, how much of them are sort of fixed and static and real, and how much of them are sort of manufactured? And then the final sort of, the actual art of the work is that they have to sell one of those objects. And they have to sell it to someone under the auspices that they don't know what it is. And then they have to document what that person's interpretation of it is, why they're buying it, what they think it might be or might be for, where they think it might be from, and use that to sort of create a taxonomy of a mythology that surrounds this thing that they've created that's now been basically generated by someone else's interpretation of it.
That's a great point for us to go to the Griner Gallery and look at your exhibit, you and Dwayne McDermott.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it is about conceptual art, yes?
I mean, yeah, if you want to sort of like, if you want to locate it somewhere, probably.
What's the name of the exhibit?
Its object is Conceptual Workbook. And okay. So, you know, we can talk more about it down
great.
There.
Sounds great.
The Ned and Gloria Greiner Art Gallery is open to the public on the first floor of Ball State's Art and Journalism Building. During our short walk, we learn that Michael is the only sculpture professor at the university. With that comes challenges, such as opening students to other viewpoints. But it also has benefits. He's able to work in the same space his students do.
I came from an undergraduate program where my faculty mentors worked in the same space that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's a really important part of understanding and learning is not that like these objects, these things that I make appear as if by magic, but that my students see me doing the thing. They understand what a studio practice, a studio discipline looks like. I don't know how else you learn that.
you learn it by doing it, and I guess that's really interesting. Do you feel like you're modeling a practice for them based on our conversation thus far?
I mean, I'm modeling my practice.
Right.
And I'm always really careful to let them know that, like, you know, that is,
this is my
how
thing.
I work. And you don't have to sort of take everything that I'm doing and go like, well, that's, you know, it's, he's doing it this way. You know, he works, I work late. You know, I'll come in at 10 o'clock and I'll work till 4.
The Greiner Gallery is two brilliantly lit rooms off of a busy food court with high ceilings and wood floors. It's an echoey space. The sculptures on the walls and on the floor are mostly recognizable objects. A tree stand, a record player, and at the entrance, a grouping of rolling suitcases. The artist tells us that's on purpose.
And so a lot of this stuff is really, you know, one of the ways in which both of us work and have worked through this show is through sort of materials that have extensions beyond art. You know, mm-hmm. there's ways to interpret the objects, the materials, the substance of what's here that does not sort of, is not predicated on your ability to understand brush strokes in an oil painting or the way that bronze has been chased on a sculpture. And instead to go like, I know what a t-shirt is. I know what a suitcase is. I know what the back of a cereal box is. I understand packing blankets. And not everyone's gonna get all of it, right? You know, different people come to it with different parts of it. And these are sort of like nodes or points of engagement that allow people to sort of bring an outside life into these things, you know?
Can you talk us through one of your pieces and some of the points of engagement that you saw when you were creating it?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Let's walk over here, I guess. This is maybe a good place to start with this piece on the wall. And so this is, all of the work in here is titled with The Problem Of. And you know, when we talk about problematics, we're oftentimes talking. It tends to have sort of a negative connotation. We're like, but problem, it's a problem.
Or, yeah, solution. Right? What is it? What's the solution?
We have to find a solution, mm-hmm. right? And or that there's a line between those two things that we can draw, and if we just find that line, everything will be okay. But the reality is that like most problems are much more complex than that, and don't really lend themselves to those kinds of solutions. Basic math is one sort of exclusion, but the higher you go in the levels of math, the further abstract you get and the more sort of circuitous those routes become. So this is called the problem of image, and the sort of larger form is modeled after an emergency call box, which we actually have on this campus. It's a piece of institutional architecture that's not exclusive to this place. It exists all over the world, you know, in lots of different forms. And my interest in that form sort of came from just seeing them, and actually it's funny because I've seen them on our campus long before I got interested in them, and then I was on another campus where all of the boxes were painted this really bright yellow, and there was this blue light in them, and I was like, that's just gorgeous, like there's something really beautiful about that. Ours are like stainless steel, and they're not nearly as aesthetic in that way for me, but I got really enamored with the form, and oftentimes for me that's where work starts, is I get really interested in something visually, and my underlying assumption about sort of how we react to things that are visually stimulating, interesting, abhorrent, is that that reaction is telling us that there is something there worth investigating that we should try to understand. And so I started going, well, what is this thing? What does a call box do? What's it for? You know, how does it function? You know, what is its place in the world? Why is it here? Why is it proliferated? Why does it exist as a multiple of itself all over the place? And, you know, and they're really about, they're, you know, they have sort of layers of function and utility. And the thing that we think about is like, well, this is here to keep me safe. But does it? Well, not really. It's there to provide you with an avenue to potentially obtain safety in a dangerous situation. But it's no promise of safety. And in fact, it's actually telling you that you may be under threat. It's telling you that, hey, there's the possibility of danger here, so we've put this here for you to access. And even if you access it, like, and most people don't sort of go through this level of discourse with themselves, you may or may not get the response that you need in the time that you need. And so they're, I'm interested in those things as an object because they pretend to do one thing, and but there is no sort of, their sort of existence is predicated on our belief, not necessarily on the reality. And so,
which so many things are.
And so, you know, here, you know, I'm looking at, you know, you've got a small 8-bit animation of a flame playing inside of this sort of structure. And then, of course, up top, you've got, you know, thousands of matches and kindling. And really, it's just, you know, it's me playing with this idea of like, what is image? You know, when does something start being image and when does it stop being image? What can an image do? What can an object do? This is volatile. This is not. We can see an image of fire, and this is obviously a very reductive image of fire, and it was intentionally sort of as simple as I could make it. None of the work that's in this show is intended to give a viewer a singular sort of experience in like, oh, okay, I saw this piece and I walked my way through it, and now I've come to this conclusion. Neither one of us are particularly interested in making narrative work that is didactic, that sort of prescribes, you know, come here, start here, end here. And both of us are sort of the belief that the work works best when we are able to trust our audience to experience similar things in different ways. That the human experience has universality to it, which does not imply that we have universally similar experience or universally same experiences, but it does imply that like we derive parts of the same thing from the similar experiences. So,
which has always been the case, right? But I feel like I thought about a lot how some of our shared experiences have moved away from being shared with the internet specifically, and how people have more ability to individualize what they're doing on a daily basis.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I think you're right in a certain way. The internet provides the illusion that we are singular. it provides sort of this cubicle for us to be in where our experience is sort of like very narrowed. On the other hand, we're all doing it. And so it's you know, and at a certain point, like our perception becomes the reality. And I think that's where we are, is that we've sort of internalized the idea that we exist in a kind of solitude, in a kind of individual state that is not transcended by other things. And so, you know, I think part of what I'm interested in art is the ability for art to kind of put some chips in that facade, maybe possibly rupture it in moments, not on a grand scale. I'm not a believer that like you make a piece of art and the world changes. The world tends to change on its own, and sometimes it aligns with art and sometimes it doesn't. But we can affect individual experience. We can affect what one person sees a little bit at a time, and that's actually how things change. I think the thing that I would love for people to do, whether they feel like they're involved in the arts or not, whether they feel like they're a practitioner or not, is to, you know, look at the world around you and, you know, don't discount sort of the materiality of things based on what you can consume readily, that something, because it's available, doesn't have sort of humanity or beauty in it. Everything that our world is built on people, and our unwillingness and our disconnection to the acknowledgement of that is fundamentally what has allowed us to dehumanize each other.
Michael Lorson is an assistant professor of art and sculpture at Ball State University. Maybe you've seen bonsai trees. Tiny trees only a couple of feet tall that look like miniatures of much bigger trees. In the movies, they're tended to by patient masters who prune one small bit at a time. We wanted to learn more about the process. So on a recent frigid day in Muncie, our producer Luke Jones and I stepped into a warm greenhouse attached to the home of Kat Dyack. Kat is the owner of White River Tropicals, where she grows, among many other things, bonsai.
Could you tell us what makes a plant a bonsai?
Bonsai, exactly translated, is plant in pot. So one could argue that any plant is a bonsai. But if you want to be technical, bonsai is a plant that has been cared for, worked with, shaped, not just the branches, but as well as the roots, potted up into more of a ceramic pot and lovingly cared for years on end. People can start bonsai and have them for a few years, and there are bonsai that have been handed down through family members because they're so old.
Wow. So is there an average lifespan of a bonsai?
I wouldn't say there's an average lifespan. I would probably say that based on the life of the trees and the life of the care, that most bonsais are going to easily live for 50 to 100 years.
Well, we are surrounded here by beautiful plants in Kat's greenhouse, and I see a large grouping of bonsai, and I was wondering if you could like pick one of your favorites and kind of talk about it specifically and describe it for our audience.
Oh, that's easy. my favorite bonsai is ficus. And ficus is more of a non-traditional style of bonsai. Original bonsai were made more from conifers, so things like junipers, spruce, those styles of plants. But ficus, for me, especially as a novice, even though I've been working with bonsai for about 4 to 5 years now, is a very forgiving plant, and it's a very fast-growing plant. So you have more of an opportunity to work with it. If you want more of that great interaction with your plant, you want to be able to do more with your plant, repot your plant more often, then the ficus is just the way to go.
Well, okay, so there's this ficus that I'm looking at right now, and it's like, it looks like a tree outside. That's what I love about bonsai. It looks like this tiny little tree you would see outside, and you're talking about how it grows fast, the ficus in particular. Mm-hmm. How do you keep it so small?
So it's all about pruning your plants. And bonsai, to me, is one step above horticulture. So in horticulture, you're pruning your plant back and you are still doing some shaping. But with bonsai, part of the point is to make your tree look like a miniature tree. You want to mimic what the tree looks like in nature. By pruning it in different directions, by feeding it, by giving it the appropriate light, and as your tree grows, and even the wire wrapping, you can shape it in order to make it look like a tree that you would find in nature.
Well, so how did you get into making bonsai, or what would you say the term is?
I would say working with bonsai.
Okay.
Because I do think it's a collaboration between you and the plant.
I love that.
It takes a lot of patience, and the plant doesn't always want to do what you want it to do. So you have to kind of work with the plant and decide, well, you know, it wants to grow in one direction, so we'll kind of take it there, but I'm going to play with it a little bit and turn it and shape it. I started with bonsai. It was right after COVID, and I was recently let go from my job. They eliminated my position at the company that I was working with, and I needed to find a new direction. And I started working with plants, and it had been a few years, and I was doing a lot of research, and I was trying to find out what plants I wanted to work with. And of course, as you're scrolling through YouTube, there's just videos popping up everywhere, and I found this crazy guy from Canada. His name is Nigel Saunders, and he has a YouTube channel called The Bonsai Zone. And he just clicked with me. And he also has a love of ficus, so that helped. And I just watched him talk to his plants and prune his plants. And as he worked with them, I'm like, I can do that. Well, it's a lot harder than it looks. And so I decided, okay, well, I'll pick up some plants and I'll try my hand at it. And I killed each and every one of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so I reevaluated what I was doing and realized that I still knew absolutely nothing about bonsai. And I went back and I watched some more videos and like, well, let's try some house plants. And so that's when I started working with ficus and realizing that it was a whole lot easier and it was definitely much more up my alley. And so now my personal collection keeps growing and growing, much to my husband's dismay. And that's really kind of where it all started from. And as I grew my own collection, as I continued to sell plants, I thought that the bonsai was a great opportunity to really introduce Muncie and the surrounding areas to what bonsai is.
So when do you know it's time for your bonsai to leave the greenhouse and go into the community?
That's a tough question because in the end, I really want to keep all of them.
Fair enough.
But as I'm working with it, a lot of them start out in little nursery pots. Some are grown from seeds. A lot of them are cuttings from larger trees, which is much easier to get the thicker trunk. And I guess you get to the point where as you're working with bonsai and you're looking at them and appreciating them, you just almost get a feeling that, okay, I think you're ready.
So there's so many beautiful plants here that you have. Are there some other plants that you would like to discuss with us?
My other favorites are air plants. I added them to my nursery collection, it'll be about 2 years in April. And I started out with just a handful. I of course, look around, see what other people have. What are people carrying? I do research online to see what's popular. And I'm like, well, air plants could be kind of fun. I ordered some in, and I got a great response from people. And air plants are unique, as they don't require any soil at all. So air plants thrive on water and light. And because they don't require soil, there's so many great things that you can do with them. And it's amazing the different shapes and sizes that they come in. A lot of people don't realize that air plants aren't always these tiny little ones that we see at the grocery store or the hardware store, that they can actually grow up to several feet long or several feet high.
I did not know that. And there's no root system that need be in soil, but is there a root system?
Some of them do have root systems. A lot of the larger ones do. One of the largest air plants out there is called a xerographica. And in nature, they attach themselves to trees. So they do end up creating a root system. A lot of times they sit in the crook of the branch and the trunk, and they'll create a root system in order for them to hold in place. And then that way they get the dappled light under the tree, they get the rain as it comes down, and they'll also get some of the nutrients from the tree as the leaves fall and rot and turn into some compost. But a lot of the other air plants are sort of free-floating.
Lovely. Well, is there any other thing you'd like to talk to us about today?
If people are interested in getting into collecting, beautifying their space, enhancing their environment, reach out to your local nurseries, reach out to me, Google, YouTube, and start with one variety. So many people jump in and they pick up like 10 plants. And then they all die because each one takes a different type of care. And as you learn, it's amazing to know that you're really not the one in charge. The plant is the one in charge because it's all about what they need. It's their light. It's how much water they need. But as I said before, as a collaboration, you need to know what's going to work in your environment.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. And I also would like you to tell everybody where they could find you if they were interested in starting a plant journey. Mm-hmm.
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Marketplace. I do appointments through my house. I also do the Delaware County Flea Market at the fairgrounds, which is the first Saturday of every month.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you.
Kat Dyack is the owner of White River Tropicals in Muncie. We talked to her in her greenhouse. It's time to ask another artist, Weiwo, what are you working on?
Margaret Reeder is the membership and individual giving manager at Indiana Public Radio, but you might not realize that she has a side gig as a waitress. Well, sort of. Here to talk about it and tell us what she's working on is Margaret Reeder. Welcome, Margaret.
Well, thank you.
So, waitress. For people that are not familiar with the movie or the musical, give us a little background on what Waitress is about.
It's about a waitress. Waitresses.
Yeah.
It's about a woman named Jenna. She's sort of the center of the story in our production, played by Brittany Kern. Mm-hmm. And Jenna and her friends and family are in this small town and work in a diner. And Jenna bakes very special pies and is in a rut, is in a loveless marriage. Mm-hmm. And we go on Jenna's journey with her as she sort of finds herself. And she's got these two best friends. You know, I love a good woman tribe, you know.
Yes.
And these three women have this beautiful relationship because they're all very different. Mm-hmm. But they all complement each other. They support each other. They call each other out, you know.
Yeah.
And they're always with each other as they're sort of becoming.
Mm-hmm. So how you feeling? Are you ready?
No. We'll get there. I mean, that's how it works, right?
It is.
The process is the process, and we're trusting it, and we jump and see if there's a net.
Yeah. You have a lot of theater experience. But you took a little bit of time off. You weren't doing like community theater and theater for a while, Margaret. And it was what, maybe a few years ago or a year ago when you jumped back in?
Yeah.
And why was that?
A little time off.
Yeah.
yeah. So I studied musical theater here at Ball State a lifetime ago. I studied musical theater performance here, and I went out into the world, and I did that for a little bit. I was very young, had a lot of energy, went out and became a performer.
Yeah,
never made enough to live on, of course. But I took a day job at a theater, and sort of found myself drawn more and more to arts administration and arts management and the nonprofit arts scene. And sort of really found my professional self through the stage door that way. And, you know, life happens, and I sort of let go of performing and moved into arts admin, and I've had a really fulfilling career there. So when you say a few years, I think it's been 24
that you didn't do any theater.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, and when you say didn't do any theater, I didn't do any performing in theater. But I sort of say that caveat because I worked in management.
Sure.
And it's one of those things that there's sort of an art to what brings all that work to life as well. That I think a lot of people don't really realize happens.
Absolutely.
But yes, it was a very long time. And last year, I decided to give it a go, and I did White Christmas at Muncie Civic Theater as well, and then took on a really demanding role in the Casaza family studio in a kooky play called Fuddy Mirrors.
Yeah, that was great.
And you know, so it's really funny to think of this hiatus, and now within a year, I'm doing three shows again.
Yeah. I'm curious to know the reason why now. Why did you feel this was the time? What pulled you back into the theater family at this time in your life?
Well, sure. There are a few reasons. Some of them are very practical. Like, my kids are older now. You know, mm-hmm. my schedule allowed for mm-hmm. it. Those sorts of things. And then I have to say, because someone asked.
Oh.
You know, someone invited me to audition. Someone said, hey, what do you think? Would you want to do this? Mm-hmm. And it had been so long, I thought, oh, I don't know if I'm up for that. And I did. And I'm so glad I did, because what I didn't realize was how much that kind of work would feed me personally. You know, like fill up that psychic bank.
Yes.
And it was something I honestly didn't really realize that I had been missing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I didn't realize that, I think that's one of the reasons, one of the whys.
Oh, I love that. So tell me about the character in Waitress. What do you love about her? What is it about that character that, as you mentioned just a second ago, kind of fills you up?
Yeah, Dawn Pinkett is, we're not alike in a lot of ways, but that's the great thing, is that when you're approaching a character, it's very rarely a black and white thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there are aspects of ourselves in these characters, and aspects of things we can relate to. Dawn is a little flower just waiting to bloom. Dawn is sort of, she's cautious. She's measured. She's meticulous. She likes to know what's happening and when. She likes to know where things are. That is her comfort zone. It's her safe space. Mm-hmm. So stepping outside of that for Dawn is a big deal. It's a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And makes her very uncomfortable. So finding that vulnerability, and finding the ability to flourish through that vulnerability.
Yeah.
It's a really fun space to occupy and to go with her. And she does. She blossoms. And she has these friends who, while they love her and accept her as she is, they also push her in healthy ways to sort of take a chance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm so glad you're taking a chance on theater again, local theater. Very excited to see you in this production. Where can people get more information about tickets and whatnot?
Sure. Check it out at MuncieCivic.org. Tickets are available. All of the show times and dates, February 7th through 23rd. And we have a couple of special shows as well for different audience needs. There is a closed captioning performance.
Great.
There's an audio described performance. Yes. So all of that information is available on the website.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Margaret, for coming in and telling us what you are working on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for the Pop of Culture Arts Calendar. Kick us off, Kara.
I sure will. Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 opens Friday, February 7th at Ball State's University Theater. Shows continue through February 14th. Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 is a modern musical adaptation from a selection from Tolstoy's War and Peace, focusing on the romantic entanglements and personal struggles of its characters. Set against an eclectic blend of electropop, rock, and Russian folk music, it offers a kinetic, experimental take on Tolstoy's classic themes of love and destiny. Details at bsu.edu/theater.
Ooh, that sounds so good. I'm going to that one. That sounds great. Opening Saturday, February 8th at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens is Clearly Indigenous, Native Visions Reimagined in Glass. The exhibit, on display through May 18th, examines how Native artists reinterpret cultural narratives and designs. The two-pronged exhibition focuses on how these artists have melded ancestral ways with new methods and materials, while also examining the historical narrative of how glass art came to Indian country. More than 100 glass art objects created by contemporary Native American and Indigenous Pacific Rim artists will be on display. Minnetrista.net has more info.
That's going to be amazing as well. Ball State's Opera Theater Program will have its 9th annual Opera Gala Saturday, February 8th at Sursa Performance Hall. The evening, now that's what I call opera.
I love that.
It's a pretty good title. We'll feature School of Music faculty and students performing opera hits together. The music begins at 7:30 p.m. bsu.edu/theater is the place to go for more info.
On display this month in Marion at the Kennedy Arts Center is Making a Garden of Strange Fruit, featuring the work of Marion-born artist Samuel Levi Jones. His project is a site of remembrance and contemplation, acknowledging the 1930 lynching of James Cameron, Thomas Shipp, and Abraham S. Smith. KennedyArtsCenter.com has more information.
This weekend is your last chance to catch the Spring Short Plays series at Ball State. Directed by Ball State students, there are 3 plays to choose from through Saturday, February 8th. bsu.edu/theater has details.
The Horizon Convention Center in downtown Muncie is hosting a winter carnival on Saturday, February 8th. Happening in the parking lot behind the convention center, the event will include, get this, Kara, ice skating, rides, games, a hot chocolate bar. What? And pics with a polar bear.
Not what?
I'm thinking it's not a real polar bear, although that would be awesome. But I think it's just someone dressed as a polar bear. The fun begins at 11 a.m.
The exhibit 5 Days by Antonio McAfee opened this week at the Richmond Museum of Art. McAfee calls his exhibition a reflection on masculinity and male figures in my family. My father, son, biological grandfather, step-grandfather, and my transition into the patriarch in my family. 5 Days features personal photographs taken by his grandfather, the artist, found historical photographs and abstract colorful patterns from personal artifacts. RichmondArtMuseum.org has more details.
Awesome. If you have an event Pop of Culture listeners should know about, let us know at IndianaPublicRadio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at IndianaPublicRadio.org.
And that's our show. This episode was produced by Luke Jones, who is now craving a piece of warm apple pie with a scoop of ice cream. With production assistance from Jack Ringenberg and a timely suggestion from Stephanie Weekman. Our show was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.